Let's go to the phone lines. And Bill in Barry. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I'm going to give you a resounding yes. He should speak because he is running for president of the United States as long as he has the Constitution of free speech. But we, the people, have to know what we're in for if he becomes president. And he has already spoken, as far as I'm concerned. I don't care what he says, but he has always, by his actions already, spoken louder than anything he could say at the Flynn Theater. He is overbooked. He is way overbooked, many times overbooked, which means he knows that he is overbooked. And when he gives these speeches and makes these promises and makes these outlandish statements, he is proven by what he is doing here in Vermont that he doesn't plan to go by what he says. I hope the whole country can focus on Vermont, and I hope everybody listening and will spread the word that this is what they would be electing, somebody who has overbooked. He knows what he's doing.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the call. We're talking. The question this morning, right out of the gates, is should Trump be allowed to speak in Burlington? Should we have denied him the opportunity to speak, as some have advocated, because of his controversial positions? If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line and Jerry in Montpelier. Jerry, you're on open mic.
Hi, how you doing this morning?
I'm fine. How are you, sir?
This is amazing. The key word that you're using is allow. Do you allow me to call your program and speak my mind? This man is running for president. Now I got to take a back step. I am not going to vote for Donald Trump. He is, I don't know, out of his mind, to tell you the truth, in a lot of his opinions. But how can you not allow, the word you're using is allow,
mm-hmm.
a man to come to my state that I've lived here for 60 years and have the opportunity? I live in Montpelier. I don't even have the opportunity to go to Burlington and listen to him speak. There's 20,000 tickets sold?
There's 20,000 that have been handed out. Only 1,400 will be allowed into the Flynn.
That's kind of ridiculous. And who chooses that? I mean, should he be speaking at Patrick Gym or, you know? But the whole point is we can't choose who we allow to come to our state and talk about running for president. We allow everyone. I disagree with him not allowing Muslims into the country. The Statue of Liberty says we will accept everybody. But this is crazy to say that we won't allow a person to come to our state to speak, to be president. It's not allowing. It's like you're allowing me to speak on your show right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We need to allow Donald Trump, Cruz, Hillary Clinton, anybody that is running for office that is going to represent this country into our state, into any state. We listen to it. I watch CNN. I listen to DEV. Come on. It's not allowing the man to be here to speak.
Hey, Jerry, thank you. You make some really good points, and I appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Bill in Middlebury. Bill, you're on open mic.
Hi, Mike. I've heard a lot of rhetoric about, you know, allowing him to speak, and I don't think that's the issue here. I think the issue is why. Why is he coming to Vermont? We have three delegates. We're obviously not going to be voting for him. He knows that. So the question is why? And I think the answer to the why is that Trump wants Hillary to lose to Bernie. Mm-hmm. And if he comes to Vermont, he's going to get a lot of airtime with the press, and that's going to be actually supporting Bernie in his quest to be able to upset Hillary, which in the end, I think Trump thinks he's got a heck of a better chance to beat Bernie than he does to beat Hillary in the polls on the national election.
That's a very good point, Bill. And let me ask this question, because I'm curious on your opinion on this. Do you think he knew the reaction that he was going to get, and he wanted the reaction that he's getting in his visit here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. Number one, Bernie's running for president. He's from Vermont. Mm-hmm. Number two, Vermont is arguably the most liberal state in the country. And so why, you know, again, he has to have, I mean, he's got a lot of smart people that work for him. We all know that. He's a very rich man. And, you know, and honestly, I don't think he's very smart, but he's got a lot of smart people working for him.
He's got phenomenal people working for him.
Right. And so I think this is planned. This is in his plan. I really do. You know, we're next door to New Hampshire. This gives Bernie more exposure. You know, his name's going to be coming up in this whole thing with Trump being here. It can do nothing but help Bernie hurt Hillary, and does nothing really for Trump in the short term of his running for the Republican reelection. So I think this is further down the road. I think he's looking to the future when and if he does so up the nomination, which I sincerely hope he does not. But if he does, I think he's looking to the future, and this is one of the steps he's doing to that end.
Hey, Bill, a very good observation, and I appreciate the phone call. Thank you. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. And what we're talking about this morning is Donald Trump's visit to Burlington. Should be, some have advocated he shouldn't be allowed to speak in Burlington, have tried to dissuade people from listening to Donald Trump in Burlington. If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Should Donald Trump be allowed to speak in Burlington? Rob, you're on open mic.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Rob.
Say, Mike, who are these people who are saying we should not? Do you have names? Their positions?
Well, there's two that, and they've backed off, to be fair to them. There were two. There were the Vermont Workers Center, and then there was State Senator and Lieutenant Governor candidate David Zuckerman. And they have wise...
Oh, David Zuckerman. Oh, yeah.
And they
well,
have,
I'm not surprised with David Zuckerman.
And to be fair, they have since backed off that aspect because of the considerable backlash that they had from free speech advocates.
Exactly, exactly. That's a point well taken by one of your callers, Mike. And I guess I would ask you, Mike, given that they backed off, why is this for you an important question to be asking your listeners?
That's a great question, Rob, because I was thinking about this as I was setting up this call last night. And I got to tell you, what kept popping into my head was the George Orwell's classic novel 1984. And I went on in the internet and found some of the quotes that I remember reading.
Right.
And he and you bear with me for a minute, Rob, because this is going to take a little while to explain. But
yeah, I hear you, Mike. I know about
but he defines the word doublethink as meaning, and this is a quote, "the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them." And I thought about this a little bit and said a perfect example of this is those that believe in the First Amendment to our Constitution and will often seek its protection of speech and religion and assembly and right to grievance, the government, but want to restrict or prevent others from exercising those same rights. And that got me thinking, it appears, and he calls them double thinkers, or double think. He says that's double thinking. And I call them double thinkers, because it appears that for some, prohibiting speech of those that offend or those that have different opinions supersedes any constitutional right of speech, and what alarms me is such speaking elevates the prospect of restricting unwelcome speech to the same level or possibly above, Rob, to that of free speech, and I think that is troublesome, and we see that trend on college campuses when speakers are bullied or harassed or disinvited to an event because they believe in something different than some faculty or students. We see this in government, actually, when
Right.
When people try to suppress public information because it might be embarrassing or negligence or worse, even criminal. And we saw it in what was the attempt, I thought, by the Vermont Worker Center and Senator State and State Senator Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman to thwart Donald Trump's ability to speak in Burlington. I know that's a long way around your question, but that's the reason I'm asking that question. I'm curious what people think about the First Amendment, what people think about speech. So does that answer your question?
It does, yeah. Very good thinking there, Mike, really. I wouldn't expect anything different from you, though. You're a smart guy. But I mean, exactly, and you're getting a reaction. I mean, are we going to just deny people from speaking their mind and actually clarifying what they believe, Mike? Because, you know, some of the things that Trump says do make a lot of sense on a gut level basis, and then because there's a lot of angst. I mean, and Bernie Sanders just came out. I just saw Bernie the other day saying, you know, he's talking to Trump voters. If for some reason, you know, you just can't pull a lever or support Donald Trump, why don't you come over to my side? Because, you know, a lot of my people are upset with the establishment, too. They're just upset with the Democratic establishment who are trying to railroad things, okay? So you have kind of a common core of emotion between diehard Trump supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters. They're just fed up with the way things are being run.
Hey, Rob, thank you very much. I got full phone lines. I got to run. Let's go to Dale in Burlington. Dale, you're on open mic.
Well, Mike, with that last explanation, I'm going to have to institute a carbon tax on you for taking up all the air in the room.
Sorry about that, Dale. But it's an important issue to me, the First Amendment.
I agree with you. I agree. My comment is, of course, he should be allowed to speak. That's his First Amendment right. The protesters should be allowed to protest legally, not disrupting business, etc. Now, if the Trump operation has created an issue here, which we will find out in the next 8 or 10 hours, by overbooking this venue, and it creates a massive safety issue, then the Trump people will have to answer to that, to the police chief, to the fire chief, to everybody. But from what I'm seeing, it appears that the fire chief, the police chief, have things under control. They have a plan in place. Once the place is full, it's full, it's locked down. If you leave, nobody else comes in to take your place. It sounds like they're prepared, they're organized, and everything should run smoothly. The protesters, it sounds like, are going to be in 3 or 4 different locations protesting, and he comes from the airport to the Flynn, whatever. That's their right, as long as they don't shut down traffic or create illegal issues. So should he be allowed to speak? Definitely. But if he does create a problem, then he has to answer to that.
Hey, yeah. Dale, thank you. Very good comments. Let's go to Travin. Is it Travin in Middlesex?
Yeah.
Travin, you're on open.
Yeah, Travin.
Travin, you're on open.
Travin in Middlesex. Thanks. Just a couple of facts, clarity. First of all, I'm actually part of the leadership team at the Vermont Worker Center, so I wanted to be clear, we didn't back off from a petition that was put out. It was put out by mistake. It was put out by a staff member without going through our process. We had a discussion, and our view at the Worker Center is that we're opposed to the idea of the government or even the owner of a facility like the Flynn, we wouldn't call on them to ban or not to allow a speaker like Trump to come. Our view is that would be a mistake, because quite frankly, things bans like that will be used, first of all, against working class organizations and against the left, much more likely than they're going to be used against a demagogue like Trump. However, we think it's actually, we're being called upon to protest and to protest vigorously. I'll be there trying to actually engage with Trump supporters and people on the fence. We'll be passing out flyers today, urging people not to be a chump for Trump, that, you know, they shouldn't be suckers just because they're angry. And, you know, I'm an angry older white guy, too. You know, a lot of the issues that people are angry about do call out for fundamental change. But, you know, Trump is clearly the wrong direction. The other thing, on one fact, on the actual polls, in the unlikely event that Bernie Sanders was actually the Democratic candidate, he would actually do better against Trump, according to the polls, than Hillary would.
Yeah, he's pointed that out a couple of times, I think.
Yeah.
Hey,
I'll just leave you there.
Travin, can I ask you a question?
Because
one of the things that I read in the press, and it concerns me a little bit, and you got to indulge me for a minute here. And by the way, I thank you for your comments. I thank you for your call. It's quite important that you do call in and talk about this. But Senator Zuckerman commented in the press, and if this is an accurate quote, this is the quote that I had. He said, "Free speech isn't universal," and I get that. I mean, if he's referring to the 1919 United States Supreme Court, where the court ruled, and I think it was a person that was handing out flyers to protest the draft, and Oliver Wendell Holmes said that was not protected speech, and that was actually the case where the infamous saying, you know, falsely shouting a fire in a crowded theater is not protected speech. That has since been overturned, and where I'm having a problem with this, you know, the Supreme Court nowadays, protected speech is more definedly and broadly, it's more broadly defined. And where I'm having a problem with that quote is that it should be as universal as possible, free speech. And I was just wondering if you had talked to Senator Zuckerman about that comment, or you have a comment on that quote. Because, boy, that when I saw that quote sort of, it was like, you know, one of those migraine headaches. It just bothered me in such a way. Do you have any opinion on that quote?
Well, Mike, I can't get into David Zuckerman's head. I'll tell you my view on this, which is that I'm opposed to the government shutting down or banning speech. That said, when there's really speech that I think is abhorrent, xenophobic, racist, speech that divides us against ourselves, I'm for vigorously protesting that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, if there's speech that's connected to organizing actual violence against a group, like the KKK organizing right. violence against black communities.
And the Supreme Court says that is not protected speech, by the way.
Right. I'm for organizing mass direct action to shut down that kind of advocacy that's connected to actual violence. So that's violence I would characterize as fascism. So people mistakenly look at a demagogue like Trump and say he's a fascist. Well, he's not a fascist. I mean, there are small fascist groups operating and trying to recruit on the periphery of the Trump movement, and they're a danger because they actually will engage in violence to attack refugees, Muslims, Black Lives Matter folks, and to try to break up union organizing drives violently. I'm for shutting those down with mass direct action, but I don't think we can rely on, we on the left and the working class movement, the union movement, we shouldn't be relying on the government to do those things, because we know, quite frankly, the government's going to use precedents like banning speech against us 9 out of 10 times. That's my personal view.
Hey, Travin, thank you so much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. Let's go to Shelley in Burlington. Shelley, you're on open mic.
It's a very interesting discussion in that no one is talking about what Donald Trump is talking about. They simply dismiss him as being racist or bigoted or a fascist or something. He's a candidate for the president of the United States. He says that our government is way too large, is too powerful, is spying on our own country, our foreign policy is horrible, we're importing millions of people, most of whom, according to our immigration laws, would not be eligible to come into this country because our immigration laws specifically prohibit people who advocate the violent overthrow of the government or the non-following of the Constitution. If you think that your culture or your religion gives you some sort of permission to beat your wife, we can't put up with that. if we think, you know, we just can't. It doesn't conform to our laws. Go ahead.
But, Shelley, let me ask you this question. I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying, and I get the frustration that's going on in this country. But isn't there a better way of doing it than insulting, you know, POWs? Isn't there a better way of coming up with a plan other than deporting 11 million people, which we can't do? I mean, I understand the sentiment behind it. Isn't there a better way than threatening the press with lawsuits or mocking the disabled or denigrating women, including, you know, conservative women? And isn't there just a better way of doing that than the way that Trump has? And I appreciate what you're saying.
That's not for us to say. His methodology is a little bit crass. We're not talking about what it is that's going on. If you have a religion where they say that it's okay for you to marry and have sex with an 8-year-old, I find that an abomination. We are permitting people who believe in those things to enter our country and alter our culture. Operation Wetback in the 1950s, they returned millions of people across the border who weren't supposed to be here. Our current administration is taking tens of thousands of children and bringing them into the country. Children that don't have parents. What would happen if you were moving children anywhere else in the world? It'd be called horrible, horrible things. No one is talking about what he is talking about. They put labels on him. You know, the communist that you just talked to says, oh, we've got to come down and protest. Protest what? Protest that this guy thinks that America should be strong and that we should be good to our allies and we shouldn't have foolish foreign policies, which we do now, which greatly endanger our nation, and you know, the spending policies of this government that are destroying our economy and putting your family and my family at great risk. Why can't we talk about that?
Shelley, I got full lines, but you make some points here that I probably would agree with. I don't agree with the fact that the gentleman that called before you, his right of protest, and you know, I've really been trying to focus this on the First Amendment. His right of protest is just as protected as Donald Trump's right to say whatever he wants to say.
I agree.
So what I want to do is move on. But thank you so much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. Let's go to Whit in South Carolina. Whit, you're on open mic.
Hey man, you are batting 100 this morning. You've had so many articulate callers calling in. It's been a pleasure to listen to the callers more than it is to you. Somebody's going to take you right off your stage, man. Look, I just want to say that I saw a very interesting show on public TV, Frontline, 2 solid hours of the Israeli relationship and why there is so much friction between Obama and Netanyahu. And it reviewed in the first hour how Netanyahu, a right-wing fanatic, came to power in Israel. And it actually shows him doing many of the same things that we could say that Trump is doing right now. Now, okay, free speech is one thing, but then public safety is another. Because whenever you have an impassioned issue, you have the crazy fringe that's out there listening. And they've got guns, and, you know, I don't want to be, you know, a fearmonger. And I don't want to inhibit free speech. But you know what happened with Netanyahu? By the way, he's in power now, and he abused his power. Remember when he called Obama a Muslim? And good Lord. And he's been trying to interfere with American politics ever since he took office. Now, I don't want to go down that road to talk about Netanyahu. You can all see Frontline and see what happened. But there was an assassination that took place because of Netanyahu. He's denying that it did. But when he incited the Israeli public against terrorism, and believe me, they were being terrorized, what happened was Rabin was assassinated. There was a crazy that came out of nowhere and actually assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. So we want to be sure that public safety is a consideration when we let people speak. There is a point, there is a fire point where we really ought to say, look, we think at this point there could be some real public safety issues if you keep on talking.
Thanks, Whit. I really appreciate it. I'm short on time. Let's get this last phone call in, and what I'll do is switch subjects here. before we do that, I appreciate all your phone calls. I mean, yesterday and today, it has been phenomenal in terms of the response that this program has gotten, and I really appreciate your phone calls, and I thank you for them. So let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Dick, you're on open mic.
Hi, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
I found the best way to approach this is governments do nothing, people do. I've had my own show up here for the last 5 years on cable television, and I've pretty much addressed a lot of the situations going on in this state and in this country. I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to protect my interest. And what I see here going on is a massive division operation that's pitting people against people, and really your rights are not being protected. And, you know, you really have to take and pay attention to this, because as pieces of this come together, it becomes a very oppressive thing. And you have to look at the people who are doing it. Like I said, governments do nothing. People do. And you got to be smart enough to find out who's doing it to you.
Thanks, Dick, for your phone call. I really appreciate it. I've got to get to a very, very patient Courtney Pletzer, and I want to just end with this, and again, thank you for your phone calls. Look, few have been as critical of Donald Trump's positions and behavior as I've been, and yet I still defend his right to say the things he does, no matter how offensive they are. And you may ask why. And it's because democracy will ultimately fail if we become, and I'm going back to something that I said earlier, because I went back and looked at 1984 last night. If democracy, our democracy will ultimately fail if we go down the path, as Orwell describes, as a nation of warriors and fanatics marching forward in perfect unity, all thinking the same thoughts, shouting the same slogans, perpetually working, fighting, triumphing, persecuting 300 million people, all with the same face. So to me, diversity of thought, of expression, of action are key to a thriving democracy, and the protection of those certain freedoms are so eloquently said in the First Amendment. And I want to leave you with what the First Amendment says. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting free speech thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or the press, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I want to apologize to our next guest, who is one of the state's nutritionists, Courtney Pletzer.
Yes.
Okay, Pletzer. Courtney Pletzer. What we want to talk about, I've run over your time, and I apologize for that. The topic we want to talk about today is the WIC program. It's the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Program. And there's going to be some changes in early March, and we'll discuss those changes in a moment. But what I wanted to, Courtney, what I really wanted you to sort of focus on out of the blocks is, what is the WIC program?
Yes, thank you for having me here today. The Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Program is a public health nutrition program for pregnant, breastfeeding, and postpartum women, and infants and children under the age of 5. We provide families that qualify for this program with nutrition and health, education and counseling, breastfeeding support, and referrals to other community agencies, as well as nutritious foods.
And what, for example, if you could give me an example, what sort of nutritional advice would you give to some of these families?
So we would probably focus, depending on who the participant is that we're seeing. If it's a pregnant woman, we'd want to focus on nutrition related to pregnancy, or nutrition related to a mom who might be breastfeeding or newly postpartum. Of course, infants and infant feeding, and then, you know, it's nutrition related to children too, preschool age, could be picky eaters or, you know, there's a variety, I think, a wide range of topics we could cover.
And if, how do I qualify for this program currently? And we'll talk about changes.
Yeah, sure. There are income requirements, which, there's a couple different ways. There's the income requirement that you would have to fall within a certain income bracket, I guess. But the main way that we can get, you know, a lot of different people onto the program would be through Medicaid or Dr. Dinosaur. So if a family who has has family members within the categories, a woman that's pregnant, breastfeeding, or postpartum, an infant or a child, if they qualify for the state Dr. Dinosaur or Medicaid insurance, they would automatically qualify for the WIC program. So that's a way we can get them onto the program.
And just help me connect the dots a little bit. I understand the nutritional advice that you would get. What other benefits would you get being on the WIC program?
Besides nutrition, I think what most people probably maybe think of when they think about WIC, they think about the food package that we give.
Mm-hmm.
So we offer nutritious foods to participants on this program. So it's a supplement to what, you know, they're buying at the grocery store. So we're giving them healthy foods to supplement what they're already buying.
And why is it important to have this program?
For the health of, those women. Pregnancy is an important time to be healthy. And giving nutritious foods to these women will help in their pregnancies and also helps kids grow.
Right. And it's not only women in their pregnancies, it's also children that you would be supplying this.
Oh, yes. Yes. There's a certain food package for each kind of category of participants on the program.
So how does a person participate in this program? Where do they go? How, you talked about that they'll be qualified through this, but how do they know about this program? Where do they go? How would they, if I wanted to participate in this program, what would I do?
Okay, well, the WIC program is run through the Vermont Department of Health, and we have 12 district offices. So I work out of the Barrie District Office, so we cover Washington County and parts of Orange North. So if you live in that area, you could call our office, and I can give you that number.
Go right ahead.
The number is 802-479-4200, or our toll-free number is 888-253-8786. If you call us, we will go over whether you would qualify for the program, first of all, and then get you a WIC appointment. So you have to come into a WIC clinic in order to get started on our program, and we would get you into a clinic to get you started.
And where would you be involved as a nutritionist, as one of the nutritionists at a regional office? Where would you be involved? Would you be at the front end of this procedure in terms of sitting a person down? What sort of procedures do you do, and how do you participate in this program?
So I often am at a WIC clinic. So the clinics that we provide, we have about 15-ish clinics a month. And actually, we do a couple outlying clinics. We're based in Barrie, but and most of our clinics are in Barrie, but we do have a clinic right here in Waterbury that we do once a month at the Waterbury Congregational Church. And we also do a clinic in Plainfield. So I'm at those clinics, and I would be sitting down with families and talking about their eligibility as well as nutrition. We also do measurements. So we do heights and weights, and we also do some iron checks on the different participants. And so, and then I would be prescribing a food package to these participants to get them started. And
what are some of the common bad habits that people may have in nutrition?
Well, we talk a lot.
Because I'm going to check them off with myself. But go ahead.
Yeah. So I think, we talk a lot about trying to increase fruits and vegetables, of course, that's always one. You know, whole grains, okay, maybe low fat milk. Yeah. I think those are, you know, we're talking about pretty, I think, basic nutrition that I think we all hear all of the time. I think it's no different.
Do I have to throw out the potato chip bag?
You know, it, you know, maybe just don't buy them as frequently. Moderation, right?
Yeah, but Costco has those big ones. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. What? Okay, let's change. Let's talk about the subject of the year here. There's changes to this program.
Right.
What are those changes?
Right. Well, so currently in Vermont, we provide, so we, the participants that are on the program get their WIC foods through home delivery. So we have a vendor who actually will deliver the foods right to our participants' houses. But starting in on April 1st, we're moving to what we're calling an eWIC card. So participants are going to start buying all of their foods in authorized grocery stores. So instead of getting that food package at their house, they're actually going to have to go to the store to buy their foods.
Will they be restricted on what they can buy with that e-card?
It is going to be very similar to the food package they have now. So there's going to be categories of foods, and there's certain amounts within each food category that they can get. So yes, there are some still some restrictions. Within each food category, there are specific types of foods they can get, specific amounts, specific brands that they'll be allowed to buy.
If I remember correctly, this program is federally funded.
Correct.
And federally mandated.
Correct.
And so the rules obviously are coming down from the federal government on this?
Yes, that's correct. All states have to be on this EBT system by 2020. So.
And one of the criticisms of EBT in other states, at least, that I know of, is the criticism of the ability to buy anything in that store, and that's not going to be the case.
That's not going to be the case. It's very specific. The foods that will be allowed to be purchased are all in an electronic system. The UPC codes on each food item is very specific, and if as a participant slides their card through the card reader at the grocery store, it will pick up on specific food items. So
how do you measure that you're successful? Is there any way that you sort of get feedback of whether you've been successful in changing the habits of people, bringing better nutrition, and those outcomes that result from better nutrition in this program?
We do have a lot of data that goes through our we have a central office in Burlington, and they take all the data that we enter and can look at rates like maybe overweight, you know, or maybe underweight or anemia. So they look at those rates, and over time, we've definitely seen we've seen those rates get better.
Mm-hmm.
So,
have you seen the need for the program increase as well?
You know, it has kind of steadied over time. Right now, we have about 1,250 individuals. It's around there. It changes frequently, but it's around 1,250 individuals who are we're in Central Vermont that we are providing this service to. It's about 900 families. So that does kind of fluctuate over, you know, up and down a little bit.
And, of course, Human Services, and you're with the Department of Health, I believe, but mm-hmm. Human Services has regional offices throughout the state, and that is,
correct.
If you're in Lamoille County, you would go to the Lamoille regional
right.
office to participate in this program. If you're in Bennington, you go to the Bennington regional
correct.
Office as well.
That's correct. There's 12 district offices, so and we all cover different areas. So our website is really good about breaking down those county lines.
Can you give me your website address?
Yeah, it's helpvermont.gov, and then you just click on Vermont WIC.
What can people do to help? Is there do you often call out for people to help? Obviously, you're here talking about the program,
mm-hmm.
the changes in the program, which is a major change, which is they're not
change.
Delivering a meal to the home. Instead, you will get an EBT card with And it's restricted in terms of what you can purchase in that EBT card. And that will start in March, is that correct?
It actually starts, well, participants will be getting their card in March. It'll start for April 1st.
April 1st. Yes. And when people have questions, do they go to your website? Do they call you? Or?
Yes. I mean, they can do either. Our website has all of the information that they may need just related to this change that's happening. But yes, feel free to call. We're always willing to talk with anyone about the program and whether they'd be eligible or, you know, just how it works. Absolutely. Anytime.
Anything else?
Well, I would like to just say if there are anyone on the WIC program that's listening, we're having learning sessions where they can come and learn how to use the new EWIC card. So call our office, go on our Facebook page. It's been on our Facebook page, which is Health, Vermont Department of Health, Barry, and come to a learning session or just stop in anytime to our office so that we can talk about the changes and give them all of the information that they might need to make this change.
And if people wanted to contact you, can you give them the number and the website?
Yes, I can. So it's healthvermont.gov and it's Vermont WIC. And the phone number for our Barry office is 802-479-4200. And our toll-free line is 888-253-8786.
Thank you very much, Courtney. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me.
The WIC program change is coming in April. You'll get your cards in March. And the big change is that the food won't be delivered to your door anymore. You will have to use an EBT card that will have the same sort of nutritional restrictions that that you do in the packets that arrive at your house. Did I get everything of that right?
Yeah, for the most part, yes.
Well, is there something that I got wrong?
No. I know it's good. It's an EWIC card, yes, and there will be certain restrictions on those cards, so it won't be anything. You can't buy just anything with it. So.
Thank you so much, Courtney.
All right, thank you very much.
One of the things that I wanted to get to today, but we're not going to have time, is what the governor should be saying in his State of the State address today. And one of the things that if I was advising the governor and it wasn't in the speech, I would have asked for a major rewrite overnight. I know that's difficult. That would have meant an all-nighter for staff. But I had mentioned this the other day. There's an angst of people that are out there right now. There are the economic conditions. People still haven't recovered from the 2008-2009 recession. But what also, there's an angst about the economic condition, the world economic condition as well. And as you see in the stock market right now, people are concerned. What's going on in China? What's going on in the Middle East? What's going on in Russia? There's that concern. And if you look at the statistics in Vermont, there's also this other concern, because the unemployment rate is not even through the state. Chittenden County has one of the lowest rates. The Northeast Kingdom hovers between 5 and 7%, which is a high rate for that. So the message I would advise to the governor would be a focus on the economy, on jobs, on the budget, even in a State of a State address, because that is where the concerns, and I've said this before on open mic, the one thing that will bubble up as the number one concern is the economy. And I think that is something that we really have to pay attention to, and most people want us to pay attention to in this state. Coming up on Open Mic, we'll talk with our friends at Talk Media News, and then we'll have a conversation, and I'm really looking forward to this, a conversation with author Howard Frank Mosier, and many of you know him. He's a celebrated author, writes mostly about characters and events in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm looking forward to that. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. And you can find the icon for our broadcast on that website address. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then we'll have a conversation, which I'm really looking forward to, with author Howard Frank Mosier of the Northeast Kingdom. And many of his books take place in the Northeast Kingdom. We'll talk to him about that, as well as other things. He has a new book out called God's Kingdom. But up first, Luke Vargas, who is usually at the UN or usually around the world someplace. Luke, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you.
What is happening to the financial markets out there? It seems like China is driving everything into a ditch here all of a sudden.
They are. They can't even basically finish a trading day this week. I think their markets, the Shanghai Composite, closed trading today after a good 29 minutes, dropping 7%. This is very reminiscent of the stock freefall in China we saw last summer. And the reforms that they implemented then to try and prevent, equity collapse aren't working. They are functioning when there's twice this week been a drop of more than 7%, which is just staggering to think about. Those markets just have shut down. It's sort of their firewall. Having the market close trading prematurely on one day does not guarantee better results the next day. And that's just what we've seen as the week gets underway. This is predominantly about internal Chinese economic issues. There have been some people that are sort of purporting it's tied to the North Korean issue. That's not the case. This is about languishing manufacturing within the country. And China has been trying to figure out many different ways to stimulate their economy over the last few years. These stock markets were actually meant to do that partly. But the underlying issues haven't changed, which is that the best way to keep the Chinese economy plodding along is to have a healthy manufacturing sector, to keep people in their jobs, and to have exports be nice and beefy. And just the data we're seeing does not confirm that that's going very well.
And part of the problem, Luke, and at least from my point of view, is that the reason you see our markets reacting to that is because we don't understand what the bottom is over there. And it's very hard to determine what the bottom is, because is it 5% growth? Is it less than 5% growth? Is it more than 5% growth? Nobody has sort of a clue in terms of what is the number that you can grab onto to find out where the bottom is. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And in addition to that, the Chinese stock markets, people say the American stock markets are the value of them is not really based on anything tangible. That may be the case partly, but it's so much more the case in China, where the price to earnings ratio in all of these companies is very, very high. It's oftentimes impossible to gauge the true value of the corporations that are trading on their indices. And so again, that's why you see precipitous drops on their stock market. It's not because those companies are losing value. It's just because the market is correcting itself. And the Chinese made a big mistake over the past few years encouraging average citizens to begin trading in these markets as a way of building up their personal wealth. They have ruined the financial fortunes of hundreds of thousands of sort of the people that matter most to this economy, which are those that growing upper middle class, has seen a tremendous amount of their savings wiped away by engaging in very risky trading that was, for a period, promoted by the government. I think they've sort of dialed that back and realized, trying to emulate Western stock markets may not be the best fit for their system. I think we're seeing that again this week.
And, of course, the old saying is when the American economy sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold as well. That is pretty much what is happening with China now. They've sneezed, and it seems like the whole world has reacted to that.
Sure. And there are also the problems here. We saw U.S. factory output in December down. It indicates a contraction in the American manufacturing sector for the first time since the middle of 2009. So we have underlying problems that actually in some respects mirror some of the problems being seen in China now. But I think the way these markets are interlinked and this sort of sneezing or coughing fit that you described is also a factor that's worsening this and preventing this news from being taken in isolation in each country. Instead, everyone panics when the other one does, and the response is amplified and worsened.
Luke, if this keeps going, I'll never be able to retire, for crying out loud. So, what?
I hope you don't have money invested in the Chinese stock market.
I
actually know some people that have, and they're paying the price for it now. But, you know, even here in the U.S., I don't think equities are as shielded as we'd like to imagine they are.
Hey, I want to, before, I know I'm hijacking your agenda here, and we'll get to that in just a minute, but I want to sort of travel to the Middle East here for a minute.
Sure.
And talk about what the heck is going on with Saudi Arabia and Iran. And if you could sort of give us a background of what is going on and the fact that there is major bad blood between these two countries.
No, yes, Saudi Arabia and Iran are arch rivals, and they don't need much of a headline to blow out of proportion. They are always looking for news happening in the other country that they can spin and interpret as some big front to their country and to sort of the religious orders that they claim to protect within the greater Arab world. This execution of the cleric on Saturday by Saudi Arabia, Nimr al-Nimr, was just such an occasion for Iran to respond. Some people have claimed, I've heard this on the radio, that he was an Iranian cleric. It's not true, but you'd think he was, given the response you saw from Iran. Of course, the embassies of Saudi Arabia were torched across Iran and sort of ransacked. That was all Saudi Arabia needed in turn to cancel diplomatic relations. And they've got the upper hand here, because when they act strongly, they've got allies in the Middle East who joined their side. You've seen the Egyptians issue a downgrade in diplomatic relations with Iran. They don't even have formal embassies, but they further downgraded trade and economic trade ties. The Emirates, where in Dubai and Abu Dhabi a tremendous amount of Iranian business is conducted, have also downgraded relations. Bahrain, Sudan have canceled diplomatic ties. So Saudi Arabia and Iran both love acting out over little news. And Saudi Arabia, just because of its position in the Middle East, gets to sort of get away with more because more countries join in and make their sort of hot-headed responses not look so crazy. But yes, this is a very big problem, not just because of the spat bilaterally here, but because civilians are going to be the people paying the price in Yemen and in Syria, essentially to certain degrees, proxy wars between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Peace talks, which seemed to be making headway last year, both look to be putting pretty far on the back burner now. It's going to be really hard, even for the U.S. and Russia, who have done an admirable job trying to, get some diplomatic momentum together at the end of last year. I don't think Moscow or Washington are going to be able to, you know, contain the emotions that are brewing up in Saudi Arabia and Iran. And so that's a very unfortunate collateral damage for the inability of these rivals to get along.
And this seemed to catch us by surprise, at least from outward appearances, it seemed to catch us by surprise.
It did, and it may have actually caught the Saudis by surprise, too. I know there's a big case to be made for the fact that these executions were not meant to trigger a tremendous response overseas. The Saudi royal family is in trouble. They have succession issues. They have, obviously, the historic low price of oil completely bankrupting the country, basically. You've got the spread of Islamic terrorism within the country, the rising risk of attacks, and many other issues. And this cleric predominantly was seen as a political opponent. He was advocating for free elections within the country. He was the voice of a persecuted Shia minority within a Sunni country. In many ways, I think they were doing this for domestic political reasons, and they may have bit off more than they meant to chew by triggering a massive international row over sort of a political crackdown. But that's what they did, and they're not one to back down and walk away with their tail between their legs. They've doubled down, and in many ways, they can get away with that because of the diplomatic cover that they enjoy.
I'm going to hijack the whole agenda here because I want to get to one other issue before we go, and we're limited on time. But North Korea, what the heck is going on there?
Well, luckily they didn't test a hydrogen bomb, as they claimed. And I know every atomic test is a threat to international peace and security, but if for some reason this country had made a quantum leap in their technological capabilities in the face of all these sanctions, that would have been doubly worrisome. And that does not look like it's happened. The response, the UN Security Council met an emergency session yesterday. The talk is of new sanctions, but I'm going to put my money against that, or at least against any meaningful expansion of sanctions. And that's because China feels like we may have gone too far. There's not only evidence that these sanctions are hurting the people of North Korea more than they're hurting the regime, but China principally does not want the collapse of the Kim Jong-un regime. Because if there is disorder and lawlessness in the country, then what you could have is tens of millions of hungry North Koreans pouring across the northern border into mainland China. And that is something China takes very seriously. And so the talk coming from Beijing now is that this should be an opportunity to begin talks, that this the threat of these sanctions should force the international community to begin the six-party talks that have been stalled for some time. I think the Chinese sort of pressure against new sanctions might end up winning the day in the next 2 or 3 weeks when the actual resolution moves through the Security Council. But for the time being, the response is strong. They're pledging unity and saying we're going to promise some strong reactions to this test. But I really don't see that playing out in the long run.
Hey, Luke, as always, really enjoy your comments. That's Luke Vargas, Talk Media Radio, Talk Media News, and I appreciate the time. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic author Howard Frank Mosier. And just let me give you just a tad of some of the awards that he's won, and they're quite impressive. He's won many awards for fiction, including from the Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the American Academy of Arts Letters Literature Award, the ACLU Award for Excellence in the Arts, the Vermont Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts, the New England Book Award, and the New England Independent Booksellers Association President Award for Lifetime Achievement in Arts. And now he has published a new book, God's Kingdom, which we'll discuss in a moment. Good morning, Howard.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me on your show. It's an honor.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have you here, Howard. One of the things I'm curious about, and maybe it's curiosity with any author, is what got you interested in writing?
Well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in writing and becoming a writer. I grew up in a big storytelling family over in Upper New York State, and I spent a lot of time living with my grandparents, and with us there lived a huge gallery of aunts and uncles and great aunts and great uncles and two great grandmothers and a great grandfather. None of them had a penny of money, but they all had great stories to tell. And growing up in that atmosphere, you couldn't not want to be a storyteller. So it's something I've always done, always wanted to do, and I can't remember a time when I wasn't scratching out little stories even before I could spell cat.
How, just out of curiosity, when I looked at your bio, it says born in the Catskills, but you grew up outside Syracuse, didn't you, or that area?
I did, up in the snow belt of Upper New York, not very far from Lake Ontario, and we did have our share of snow, but not the cold that northern Vermont has, and also our winters were much shorter.
Whereabouts in the Catskills were you born, just out of curiosity?
I was born in a little town called Chichester, which actually not long after I arrived on the scene became a ghost town. It was a company furniture factory town, and the factory went out of business, and then the town went out of business. I wrote about it in my third book, Marie Blythe, and moved the town and the furniture factory to the Northeast Kingdom.
Now, if you could just explain sort of the, how did you arrive in the Northeast Kingdom or to Irisburg?
Well, I was laboring under the mistaken impression that someplace out in the world was a blueprint that would show me how to write stories that somebody other than my mother might want to read. So when my fiance Phyllis and I were close to graduating from Syracuse University, we thought that maybe I could find that blueprint in graduate school, but we didn't have any money, and all we could think of was to try to find a couple of high school teaching jobs for a year or two, save some money, and then maybe we'd both go on to graduate school. So we heard about a science teaching job, that was Phyllis's field, and an English teaching job in Orleans, Vermont, way up in the Northeast Kingdom. And we didn't know what the Northeast Kingdom was or where it was, but in the spring of 1964, we drove up to the kingdom to interview for the jobs, and we had an interesting introduction to Orleans. We arrived on a Saturday afternoon, and the town was almost deserted, except for a couple of guys right in the middle of Main Street having a fist fight. And so I can't believe I was ever this young and naive, but I was. I stopped the car and rolled down the window, and I said, "Excuse me, but could one of you gentlemen please tell us how to get to the local high school?" And they suspended, and that's the operative word, they suspended their fist fight, and the bigger of the two guys said, "We can do better than that. We can take you there." And so, without invitation, they piled into the back of my grandparents' car, which we borrowed for the day. And of course, they were just falling down drunk, but they directed us all over town and got us lost in blind alleys and over in the lumber yard of the Ethan Allen Mill. And finally, we got to the high school, and I thanked them, and they got out of the car and headed off down the street arm in arm. And as we turned into the parking lot, Phyllis tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, "Look back." And I did. The two guys had resumed their fist fight in the middle of School Street, and that was our introduction to the Northeast Kingdom. But we got the jobs, and what I discovered right away was that I had just by sheer chance stumbled onto a gold mine of stories that no writer had ever told before. And I think the Northeast Kingdom became my graduate school, because that was almost 52 years ago, and we've been here almost ever since.
You've written 13 books, starting with Disappearances in 1977. The Kingdom has been the backdrop of most of your books. Why?
Well, I think, again, because of the wonderful stories that I've discovered here. When we first showed up in the kingdom in the middle 1960s, a lot of the people dated back to the Prohibition era and those terribly difficult Depression era years, and they'd had pretty hard scrabble lives, but interesting lives, and they all had stories to tell about them. And I'll tell you one quickly. Not very long after we arrived in the kingdom, our landlady invited us over for coffee and cake, and she told us that back during Prohibition and the Depression, she and her husband were just on the very brink of losing their little dairy farm. They just simply couldn't make the mortgage payments from their milk check. And of course, that was happening to farmers all over Vermont and far beyond in those years. But she decided that she would put to use the one skill she had learned from her father, and that was making moonshine whiskey. She hated to do it, but she built a little still, and she ran off just enough of the stuff to sell in Orleans and Barden and Newport and keep that farm going. Well, one night, as she was running off the moonshine by lantern light, she looked up across the little nearby brook, and there she saw what she described as a pair of city shoes with a man wearing a city suit standing in them. And she knew he had to be a revenuer, so she thought quickly and said, Mister, you can arrest me if you want to, but I want you to know that if you do, we're going to lose our farm. And when she looked up again, the guy was gone. Well, she held on to the farm, and years later, her husband died rather suddenly, and she continued to farm alone for a decade or so, but eventually she got older, it became too much for her, and so she moved into Orleans. And some years before my wife and I showed up to teach at Orleans, there was a knock at her door, and she recognized the guy standing there in the city shoes, in the city suit. Hadn't seen him in 25 years, but she knew who he was, and she said to him, have you come to arrest me again? Of course, it was the ex-revenuer, and he said, no, ma'am, this time I've come to marry you. And he did, and she was very happy with him, just the way she had been with her first husband. And then after a year or so, he became sick suddenly and died. So when she finished the story, to answer your question, Mike, when she finished the story, she looked at us and smiled, and she said, now, Howard and Phyllis, I don't want you to think I'm complaining. I've had a very, very good life, but I reckon I just ain't had good luck keeping my husbands alive. And at that moment, I looked at Phyllis, and she looked at me, and we knew that I was going to write the stories of the Northeast Kingdom, and I haven't run out yet.
A wonderful story. Howard, we're speaking with noted Vermont author Howard Frank Mosier, and if you would like to join our conversation, give us a call at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll-free 877-291-8255. Howard, is there a theme? Could you describe a theme that weaves through your various novels?
I think that probably the tremendous independent-mindedness of my characters, beginning with Quebec Bill, the ex-Prohibition-era whiskey runner and disappearances, and Noel Lord, the logger who, even though his beloved land is going to be flooded out by a hydroelectric dam, refuses to leave, and the character Burl, who's based on our first landlady and whose story I tell, and Where the Rivers Flow North, and of course all the crazy Kinnisons, right up to the crazy Kinnisons in the new book God's Kingdom. I think it would be that tremendous sense of being independent, and I think that probably is the characteristic of people in the Northeast Kingdom and many ways throughout Vermont that I admire most and that keeps recurring in the books.
We have a caller, Rusty DeWeese from Stowe. Rusty, you're on open mic with Howard Frank Mosier.
Well, hi, Howard. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Rusty?
100%. I won't take much of your time, Mike and Howard, but I lived in New York City in my 30s, and I never was a reader. And one of my fancy smart friends who was a reader had a fancy smart girlfriend who read, and they sent me down a book, and it was Disappearances. And I read that book in my apartment on 81st Street, and I was reading it. I was trying to be an actor, and I thought, boy, this stuff was written as if it was written for me. It'd be fun to be in a movie someday and do one of these movies. And I've had the pleasure to be in many of Howard's movies. And I'm just going to say to the listeners, run right out and buy every Howard Frank Mosier that's on the rack, because you'll never turn back. And I hope you're doing well, Howard. I just passed Irisburg. I was up in Derby this morning, so I just passed the road to Irisburg.
It's still here, Rusty. And I want to thank you for your wonderful work as Harlan Kittredge. Speaking of independent-minded, Carlin was a fun character to create, and you brought him alive in a number of Jay Craven's movies. And I'll tell you, I love Harlan dearly, but I would not want to get on his wrong side. And you brought that alive, too. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Howard. I had a lot of fun with you. And I tell you what, Harlan Kittredge's ghost is probably waiting in line for the Donald Trump show today, right?
I'm sure he is.
I'm listening to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Rusty, thank you for your call. Speaking of the movies, as Rusty just talked about, four of your books have been converted into Jay Craven films. Did you discover anything about your characters or about yourself during that process?
Well, I loved the way actors like Rusty and Chris Christopherson and Martin Sheen and Michael J. Fox would bring these characters alive in a somewhat different way from the way I had envisioned them. I decided early on when Jay began making my stories into his wonderful movies that a movie and a novel are two entirely different entities. And I love each of Jay's movies. Their vision is somewhat different from mine, but I love it. And it was amazing to see, and I'll use Rusty as an example, turn into Harlan Kittredge. The second those cameras started to roll, it was like magic to see that. The only time I ever questioned Jay about a decision he made with the movie was when he began Stranger in the Kingdom in a different way from the way I had begun it in the book. And I thought that in the screenplay that had been written for Stranger in the Kingdom, they had used my beginning. So I asked Jay about that, and he said, yeah, he did write my opening scene, but as much as he liked it, he couldn't use it. And then he explained why. He said, Mosher, you have, if you need them, 400 pages to tell your stories in. I got 90 minutes. I got to get to the story right away. And that's when I had my little epiphany and realized that a movie was one thing, a novel was something else again. But Jay, with his wonderful casting and directing and the terrific cinematography in all of the movies, has just brought my books alive to me in a new way. And also, each of the four books that Jay made into movies sold much better after the movie came out than they ever had before. So I am grateful to Jay on many levels.
We're speaking with noted Vermont author Howard Frank Mosher. If you wish to join the conversation, call us at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's go to Greensboro Bend. You're on open mic.
Hi, Mr. Mosher.
Hi.
We bought our house on French Hill Road in Greensboro Bend in 1996. And I got a hold of Stranger in the Kingdom, and I was so glad I was home. My grandfather was the doctor in Johnson for 60 years, so though we grew up outside of New York City, we were Vermonters. But in every one of your, well, I don't know everyone, but in many of your books, baseball is so important. And I hope you can tell the story. I never had a reading experience in my life like reading Waiting for Teddy Williams a month before the World Series. And no one will ever have that experience again. It was incredible. And I think it has something to do with you were on the New Jersey Turnpike and pulled into a McDonald's to write the story. But if you could tell that to people, and I hope everybody reads it and tries to remember what it was like when we hadn't won the World Series for a long, long time. And thank you so much for your epiphany.
Well, thank you, and thank you for asking that question. Waiting for Teddy Williams came to me in an entirely different way from any other inspiration I've ever had. I was driving on the New York State Thruway late at night, coming back from, I think, a book tour out west, and I probably was too tired to be driving, and all of a sudden, through my mind, there flashed an image of a little boy looking out of a sideways window that Vermont is kind of famous for, and it was night, and the moon was out, and leaning against the barn door, smoking a cigarette, was a guy who looked a lot like Ted Williams in a picture I have of the great Red Sox hitter leaning on his bat in the on-deck circle and looking out towards some hapless pitcher that he was about to light up. So I knew two things. I knew I really was too tired to drive. I had to stop and get off the throughway and get a cup of coffee. But I also knew I needed to write down what I'd seen, even though this image went through my mind in just a split second. So I stopped at a McDonald's in Batavia, New York, and in the next 5 minutes, I outlined all of Waiting for Teddy Williams, right down to the title of the book. And all I can think of is that subconsciously I'd been thinking about those characters in that story. Well, it was a fairly quick book to write, but it still took a couple of years. And the year before the Sox won the series and the book was published, I actually found myself playing the role of a traitor because I did not want the Sox to win the series in 2003. I wanted them to win in 2004, which a month after the book came out, they did. But it was sheer coincidence. And thank you so much for that question.
Let's go to Don in Morrisville. Don, you're on open mic with Howard Frank Mosier.
Good morning, fellas. Mike, I don't know whether Howard's mentioned it to you, but he has a daughter that he really should be proud of and do a little writing about, too. Those of us that know Annie would tell you that she is a spitting image of Bette Midler and at least as funny. I have not seen her in some years since she was on the track team there at Lakes Region, but she's not a person I'll forget.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And Annie was Annie is now a singer and songwriter in Nashville, and she was the inspiration for the wild and funny character Gypsy Lee Allen in Waiting for Teddy Williams. Everybody's seen this disclaimer on the first page of most novels that say the characters are not based on real people. Well, who else would they be based on if not on real people? And he definitely inspired Gypsy Lee in God's Kingdom, my latest book. Young Jim Tennyson's love interest, Franny, was inspired by my wife, to whom, as usual, I have dedicated the new book to Phyllis, a.k.a. Franny.
Howard, I'm going to take a short break. We'll come back. What I want to talk about is your writing process. How do you write a novel? And then, of course, I want to talk about your new book, God's Kingdom. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with noted Vermont author Howard Frank Mosier, and it's been a fascinating interview. We welcome your phone calls if you wish to join our conversation. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Howard, how do you write a novel? What's the process that goes into it when you write a novel?
Well, usually with me, just as I based many of my characters on real people, I will start with a real story, often one that that happened in the Northeast Kingdom. And over the course of many, many revisions, the story begins, like Jay Craven's movies, to acquire a life of its own. At least it does when it breaks the right way for me. It doesn't always break the right way. Sometimes it breaks like a curveball that's a foot off the outside of the plate and nobody's going to swing at it. Then you put it on the shelf for a while. I usually start about 7:30 in the morning. I write every day, seven days a week, and, you know, unless I take a day off to go fishing or drive up to Montreal for a change. And I work right until, really, I'm too tired to work anymore, sometimes 2 or 3 in the afternoon on a good day. I can write 4 or 5 pages a day, but I may write those 4 or 5 pages 40 or 50 different ways until I get them close to right. I write by hand on yellow legal tablets. I don't really know why I do that, except I always have. And then I have a typist, the same one I started out with more than 40 years ago. And a lot of the novel writing is really hit or miss. And you know, you're looking into your subconscious, and I suppose in some ways into your heart, to see what you can find there. Somebody said to me the other day at an event that she was just an aspiring writer, and I interrupted briefly, and I said, well, believe me, so am I. Every time I go to my desk in the morning, I am just an aspiring writer. But I think it's the stories and the people of the Northeast Kingdom that have inspired me to write all of these years, and I'm so grateful to them for helping me write my stories.
Are you ever surprised where you take the characters?
Always surprised. Yeah, that has to happen at some point, or the story just doesn't work out. Everyone says, you know, does the character really come alive and take over? It sounds like a cliche, but yes, they do. And that's a good moment when that happens, and it might happen only, you know, once or twice a month. But then sometimes you really know you're on the right track.
Your new book, God's Kingdom, what's it about?
Well, it's a coming-of-age story set in the 1950s, and it follows Jim Kennison, the young narrator of my 1989 novel, A Stranger in the Kingdom, through his high school years. And Jim, unlike his crazy older brother, Charlie, the local attorney, is an earnest young man who, as I did years ago, has set out to become a story writer and to tell the stories of the place I call Kingdom County. And over the course of the new book, God's Kingdom, he looks into a number of very dark mysteries, including some dark family mysteries, and including several murders, which he's determined to get to the bottom of, and eventually, to some degree, does. One of them involves the murder of Pliny Templeton, who is based on the character of Alexander Twilight, who Millbrook College claims is the first African-American college graduate, and who came to the Northeast Kingdom in the 1830s and built a wonderful granite academy in Brownington. And in God's Kingdom, Pliny has dedicated his skeleton to the local school that Jim Kennison attends, and unlike Alexander Twilight, the character Pliny Templeton, we know was murdered, and in fact by a member of Jim's family, because the skeleton has two holes in his head.
What is the thing that I find fascinating when you talk about characters, and characters are from real people, as you discussed, have you ever had anybody come up to you and say, that character's me?
Oh, yes. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're half right. Many of my characters, I think, are combinations of different people I know, probably with aspects of myself thrown in. I had a terrible time getting the handle for my novel, A Stranger in the Kingdom, which is based on the so-called Irisburg incident of 1968, a horrific racist incident that took place just up the street from where my wife and I have lived now for many years, the kind of thing you would think would happen in Mississippi in the 1920s, but it happened much more recently in Vermont. I just couldn't seem to get the handle for that book. I worked on it for a couple of decades. Finally, one night I wrote a sentence and didn't know I was going to write it, but it went something like, when I was a boy growing up in Kingdom County, my father and my older brother Charlie couldn't say two words to each other without getting into an argument. And I realized that was young Jimmy Kennison's voice, and that was the way to tell the story. But once I brought Jimmy into the story, quickly his father, the local newspaper editor, and his mother and his older brother, the attorney, came to me, and they are all based on members of my own family.
Are you, I don't know where this question popped right into my head. Are you still considered a Flatlander in Irisburg?
I don't know about that. Probably. I think you'd really have to be born in Vermont to be considered a Vermonter. Rusty Dewey's brought up Donald Trump. Donald Trump would have a field day with me with the birther issue because I wasn't born in Vermont, but I write about Vermont. When I finished A Stranger in the Kingdom, I said to my wife, Phyllis, well, everybody in this town is going to be mad at me for dredging up this story and publicizing it. And Phyllis said to me, you're right, they are, and that's one reason you had to write it. That's the first thing I want to tell you. The second thing I want to tell you is they'll get over it, and she was right.
Howard,
I've
got to tell you, when I lived in Hardwick, I was at a local establishment one night, and this gentleman bumped into me, and he goes, you Flatlander. And I was offended. Because I tried to explain to him, look, you know, I was born in Vermont. I grew up in Vermont. I graduated high school from Vermont. I graduated from the University of Vermont twice. I said, why am I a Flatlander? He said, well, where were you born? I said, Rutland. He goes, anything Route 4 and below is a Flatlander.
I can use that. You mind if I steal that from you, for the book I'm currently writing? I'm surprised he extended the citizenship of Vermont as far as Route 4.
I know. I don't think he ever had been to Route 4, so I was really impressed. Writing a book and promoting are two different skills. Do you find each enjoyable as equal in enjoyment?
No, most of the enjoyment, although sometimes it's a mixed blessing, comes from writing the stories. But I like to go out and promote the book because that's the only chance I really ever have to feel like a author. One of the things about writing is it's a very isolating profession, particularly writing novels, because they take so darn long to write. You know, each one takes from, well, a minimum of 2 years to 5-6 years. As I said, A Stranger in the Kingdom I worked on off and on for almost 20 years. So it's fun to get out and actually meet my readers and thank them. And in fact, I'm coming to Stowe, to the library at 7 o'clock on January 14th, and I'm looking forward to thanking my readers in that area.
Yeah, you stole my thunder here, Howard. I was going to say, you'll be at the Stowe Free Library on January 14th mm-hmm. at 7 o'clock. If you wish to meet Howard, please attend that outing. Where can people purchase your book?
Oh, at Bear Pond Books and Store, any other independent bookstore in Vermont. I probably shouldn't say this because my loyalty is entirely to the independent bookstores, but you can of course get it on Amazon.com and at the chain stores like Barnes and Noble.
Howard, it's been a pleasure and it's been an honor to have the opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I thank you for your time. You've been very generous with your time.
Thank you, Mike. This has been fun. Thanks for your good questions.
Well, thank you, Howard. Howard Frank Mosier, noted Vermont author, well-respected author nationally. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Just wanted to thank all our listeners and all our callers today. Great conversation, both at the beginning and with Howard, in terms of Howard, with Frank Howard Mosier, in terms of what we have, what he is writing about and what we're doing. Tomorrow on Open Mic, we'll be at the State House. We'll be speaking with, first out of the blocks, with Don Turner, House Minority Leader, with Senator John Campbell, Senate Pro Tem, with Senator Joe Benning, the Senate Minority Leader, and Sarah Copeland Hansis, who's the House Majority Leader. And, of course, I want to thank our guest today, Frank Howard Mosier, and also Courtney Pletzer, who was talking about the WIC program. But most of all, I want to thank you. I want to thank you in terms of the phone calls that we had. We had a record number of phone calls yesterday. We could have done a record number of phone calls today. I wanted to mix things up today, but I really want to thank you. And tomorrow, when we speak with these representatives and senators, we'll be talking about the governor's state of the state address, whether he, as I advised, whether he tackles the state's economy. I think that's the number one issue that is on everyone's mind. So thank you again for joining us today. I want to thank our guests, as I said, and I want to thank you. This is Open Mic.